May it please the Court, my name is Paul Turner. I'm with the Federal Public Defender Office in Las Vegas, Nevada. I'm here this morning to represent Toby Bishop. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor. Thank you. Obviously, I'm here to respond to whatever areas the Court wants to get into, but I would like to deal principally with equitable tolling this morning. I'm certainly not waiving my statutory tolling argument, but I believe the most important things I have to say this morning are in the area of equitable tolling.
Do you want the statutory tolling question now or at the end?
Your Honor, I think it's whatever's convenient for you.
In the argument, in your brief, there is the effort to show inadequacy of the rule. I'm not clear in my mind where that fits in to statutory tolling. It seems to me that's an entirely different issue. And this case is not the only one that we have on this calendar that has this situation. So why should we incorporate whether the rule is inadequate into the issue of statutory tolling? And do you have a case that shows we should?
Your Honor, the cases that I cited, the Ford case and cases dealing with new rules, the twist to this case, I believe, and maybe to some of the others you're referring to, is that we have a situation where in our judgment, the law changed in Nevada, and my client received a retroactive application of that law, which rendered his petition untimely under Nevada law.
I understand, but my difficulty is the inadequacy rule, which you've taken from the procedural default cases and tried to make applicable to statutory tolling. There seems to me to be different things, and I haven't found a case that says that you can do this.
Your Honor, I think generally speaking, you're absolutely correct, and I understand where you're coming from on that. I think the first thing that I'd say, as I already said, is that this is a situation where we're looking at a new rule that was applied. That makes it a very small subset of cases involving a new rule. We're offering that as an exception to the Siebert situation, to the comment in Pace about when state courts make a ruling on timeliness, that's the end of the discussion. We believe that they don't mean, and that ultimately the Supreme Court hopefully will tell us, that they don't mean that it's the end of the discussion when a new rule is being applied. That would be a very, very harsh rule to apply to somebody, and we believe that should be an exception. We also think in this circuit, at least in an unreported case, the concept of the issue of whether or not the state decision is totally insured or protected, you can't go behind the state decision. That issue has been offered as a possible issue, and I've seen that in other cases too.
Mm-hmm.
It's a question of whether the state ruling is just bulletproof completely, and we don't think it should be where it's applied in this context to deny someone a federal right.
Don't let me lead you too far astray. I know you've used up almost half your time on my straight question.
Because in light of pace. You know, even though I understand your argument, we have a little more constrictions. On equitable tolling, I'm trying to understand the state of Nevada law. I know what Gonzales said. So did Gonzales depart from Kellogg, or did it just merely, in a way, extend this issue for the first time to habeas situation?
Well, in our position is that it departed from Kellogg, from a reasonable reading of Kellogg, because Kellogg is obviously based on Houston v. Lack, and in Kellogg, the Nevada Supreme Court endorses Houston, embraces Houston, and as Your Honor is probably aware, the case is following up on Houston in many state courts and also certainly in the federal system and right here in this court. Houston has been extended and moved into area of post-conviction. I think it's fair to say that probably almost every lawyer you could have asked, probably in Nevada and probably here, before the Gonzales case would have said, of course, the mailbox rule applies. And I think there's a real shock when Gonzales came down.
We have some cases, I think they're memorandum dispositions, where petitioners relied on Dictato v. Ducharme and for the notion of the mailbox rule, and then we said, well, in light of that, Pace didn't kick them out for purposes of equitable tolling if they moved expeditiously. But I don't see any indication in the record here about Bishop relying on Dictato in any way. Does that matter?
We believe the reliance, Your Honor, that's contemplated in Pace, in Harris, in this circuit, in Towns, Townsend case, we believe it's a constructive reliance. It should be a categorical rule and is a categorical rule. We believe that the rule would be that if you constructively rely on the existing case law when you're filing, that coupled with, and the most important factor, we believe, is diligence. And that, indeed, is the message of Pace. Mr. Pace would have gotten his equitable tolling if he had been diligent. He was grossly undiligent. He spent years wasting time not going back into state court and then not going into federal court.
So the first notice he might have that he was untimely would be the order to show cause in May, being kind of the first possible inkling?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And then he files within a couple months of that.
Yes, he does. He doesn't really know he's not timely until July 1 of 05 when the Nevada Supreme Court.
Dismissal.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the remitter, under Nevada law, a case isn't final until the remitter comes down. That was on July 26th. The day before, he's in federal court. Mr. Bishop is an extremely diligent litigant.
I want to ask you a question about your argument that he should be deemed to have constructively relied on Dictato and that it's categorical, I think was the term that you used. What is your best case for the concept that equitable tolling is to be applied in the absence of actual individual reliance on something or actual individual inability for a particular reason, that it's to be applied in that broad fashion?
I understand, Your Honor. I think Harris is the, of course, the most important case that we're looking at here, coupled with Pace. In Harris, they do talk about a good faith reliance, but they cite to the Jones v. Blanas case out of this circuit in 393 F3rd 918, which is cited. And if you look at Jones, they cite to Jones for what is a good faith reliance, basically. What is good faith? If you look at Jones, Jones is the case where a person was not gaming the system. I don't know if that's Justice Scalia's words or somebody else's, but the idea that I think is applicable here is that it's equitable from the point of view that the litigant is doing his best legitimately to present his case. He's not trying to play games with the court. He's not trying to waste the court's
equitable
time.
Equitable tolling is not merely for people who aren't playing games. Someone could wait 5 years in good faith while they're diligently looking in the law library, and they're not really in bad faith or sneaky or any of those things. I guess I just have difficulty with this idea that the reliance type of equitable tolling occurs without any actual reliance on the part of the individual.
I understand, Your Honor. I think one area that I cited in my Rule 59e motion, which is in the record in the district court, that there are a series of cases, they end up often being tax cases, where courts have made it clear that the old idea that you hear almost the first day of law school or maybe first day of being an adult, that you're held to know the law as a citizen of this country, that has a reverse to it also, that to the extent it makes you have a duty to do something, you're held to know the law, but you're also presumed to know the law when it's a benefit that you're going to get. So in the tax cases, the taxpayer did not know specifically, actually know about an old tax case, but he is given the benefit of that law in order to conclude that he didn't commit fraud.
I understand your position, but this individual was represented by counsel at the time, by the time of the order to show cause in May of 2005.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
He had no counsel until his federal petition would have been, absent dictato, his federal petition would have been untimely years earlier before he ever got counsel. He didn't get counsel until, I believe, early 2003, I think it was, in state court. It would have been too late. He'd have been out completely. So this is a pro se litigant here. This is not a lawyer-represented litigant.
Well, the reason the May date seems important to me is if we gave you the benefit of my math may be off here, but it seems to me that if we were to give you the benefit of all of the different forms of tolling, that by the time of that May 17, 2005 order, he had to know at that point that there was a timeliness problem because of the order to show cause. And yet the federal petition was not filed for more than two more months.
Your Honor, can I respond to that?
Sure.
He couldn't file his federal petition and keep it in court. Under the Raspberry case that's come down from this court, he had no exhausted claims because he had never had a direct appeal. He couldn't have kept a federal petition in court. Also, until Rhines in March of 2005, he couldn't even get a stay. So he couldn't have stayed in court. It would have been a total waste of judicial resources for him to file a federal petition at that point.
He couldn't even have filed a protective federal petition.
No, he could not have. I mean, he could have filed a piece of paper, but it's going to be kicked out. There's no way to stay. The Raspberry case makes that pretty clear from this circuit. And I think that's clear from Rose v. Lundy. Here, though, he had no exhausted claims, so there's no way he could stay in court. And his only option was to get through the state system and then get to federal court, which he did one day before the remitter issued. You can't be any more diligent than that. One other thing, unless Your Honor has a question on that, I'd like to mention one thing as a tail to my argument is an equal protection argument here. There are other cases in this circuit where people have gotten the relief Mr. Bishop is asking for, unreported cases. And our position under Myers v. Ilst, the equal protection case out of this court, would be that it denies him equal protection for others to get that benefit and for him to not get it. As an aside, a housekeeping item, and I apologize to the court, one of the cases, Sullivan, which is out of our office, is back in this court now. And I should have probably filed a notice.
Yes, you have to.
I apologize for that.
So after court, would you go ahead and
I will do that.
File whatever you need to file?
One question.
Yes,
I know we've run you way over your time. At the time that there was a response required to the Nevada Supreme Court, your client did not say he was relying upon the mailbox rule at all. Would that be a waiver, bringing it up later? The Supreme Court, after all, has said, tell me what the problem is. Then he doesn't mention mailbox rule. Then later on he says, this is really what my case is about.
Well, obviously it would have been infinitely better for him to have mentioned the mailbox rule, as we would hope any litigant would. But that was the law in Nevada. And as I pointed out in my reply brief, Your Honor, when you go to 34.726, the timeliness statute in Nevada, the first case you see listed there in the annotations is the Gonzalez case, the mailbox rule. And that is...
So he should have been relying on it under Gonzalez, but he was not. So...
Well, his lawyer... I'm sorry to interrupt you, Your Honor, but his lawyer did not mention it. Unfortunately, that happens. Sometimes lawyers don't mention what the law is, but that was the law.
That's what waiver's about, his statements to the court as to how your case can be tried. And we don't go back and say, do you really mean it? We look at the lawyers, and they're competent to represent clients. And I'm just curious. It's usually when a situation like that comes up, they've waived the right to argue subsequently of the mailbox rule. I just wanted to get your response.
Your Honor, you're absolutely right. And my only question would be that where it is the only rule in the state, it is the essence of the state timeliness bar, where it's the first listed case, I think it's – frankly, I think every judge on that court knew the mailbox rule, and certainly most lawyers. Now, a lot of us don't practice – a lot of people don't practice post-conviction law very well. They don't practice it much, and they may be careless. And this lawyer may have been in that box. But that was the law. It's like saying equal protection is not you have to say it every time. I mean, you don't really have to say it every time, I don't think. Well, maybe you do, and I understand. I have a feeling in this court you do.
It's an uncomfortable place to end.
Thank you.
We'll hear from Mr. Wilson.
May it please the Court, Dennis Wilson from the Attorney General's Office, appearing on behalf of Warden Foster.
You want to keep your voice up, please.
I will, thank you. I think it's basically been conceded that under Pace and Allen v. Siebert, because the State Supreme Court found that Bishop's post-conviction petition was untimely filed, therefore he's not entitled to statutory tolling. The argument that Bishop makes is that because the allegedly new prison mailbox rule in Gonzales was not adequate for purposes of procedural bar, therefore somehow his state post-conviction petition was properly filed, and consequently Bishop was entitled to statutory tolling. This argument has no merit.
I'm more interested in equitable tolling, if you would turn to that. Why wouldn't he be entitled to equitable tolling even if he's not entitled to statutory tolling? Because before Gonzales, Nevada law was unclear as to the potential application of the prisoner mailbox rule to a habeas petition.
Well, the first reason that he's not entitled to equitable tolling is because he never raised equitable tolling. He waived equitable tolling by not raising it before the federal district court. He never argued for it in his state habeas, state district court habeas opening brief, and he never argued it in his federal district court opening brief or his federal district court reply. And because he never argued it, he then filed his Rule 59e motion under Harris v. Carter. And before he could get in the door under Harris v. Carter, he had to show that Harris v. Carter was a change in controlling law. The district court correctly found that Harris v. Carter was not an intervening change in controlling law because, one, Harris did not overrule any prior precedent. Two, Bishop never argued equitable tolling on any point argued to or addressed by the federal district court prior to the entry of final judgment. The third reason that the district court's ruling was correct was that he didn't need the benefit of Harris to make the argument that he relied on Dictato versus Ducharme. He could have made that argument on himself. He didn't raise that argument until he saw Harris versus Carter and said, oh, this applies to get me in the door because I didn't raise it in federal district court. He could have made that argument at any time, but he didn't.
So your bottom line position is that he waived the ability to even make a statutory tolling argument.
Equitable
tolling.
Yes, that's correct, because it's clear that it was never raised before the federal district court, and the federal district court clearly found that. He then tried to get it in under Rule 59E. Saying it was changing in controlling law, which it's not. So he's not entitled to equitable tolling. Going back to the statutory tolling argument, as Judge Wallace mentioned, the argument that the procedural bar somehow under Gonzales somehow entitles him to statutory tolling is without merit. The argument is without merit because it confuses and improperly mixes the principles of procedural bar with the principles of statutory tolling. Even if the State Supreme Court had applied a new rule, that new rule would only overcome the procedural default. It would not have anything to do with statutory tolling.
I have a question going back to equitable tolling. At the time the Nevada Supreme Court issued its order to show cause in May of 2005, opposing counsel says that it would not have been possible for his client to have filed a federal petition at that time because the state claims were not exhausted. Do you agree with that or not agree with that? And at that moment in time, was there still time left to file?
Well, just the first thing I'd argue is that this issue was never raised until now. It's never been raised in federal district court. It's never been raised in the briefs. First time I heard that this was an issue was this morning. So he can't raise that matter for the first time on appeal. So I'd ask the court not to address that. I haven't had a chance to respond to it. I've seen it in other cases, but I haven't had a chance to respond to it in this case. He can't raise it for the first time on appeal.
Well, that's kind of an odd one. That would be more one that the state would be raising, which mm-hmm. Is to say, well, even if there's equitable tolling, you should have filed a protective petition and hoped for stay in abeyance or whatever. I mean, normally it's kind of raised reflexively, so it's kind of in an odd posture here. I kind of want to go back, though, just to the basic question. At the time that Bishop filed his petition, it seems that the state of the law was that everyone assumed mailbox applied because of Kellogg. Is there anything to suggest otherwise at that point?
Well, there is, Your Honor. Okay. As I mentioned in my brief, I completely disagree that the Kellogg rule in 1992, which basically held that when an inmate files a notice of direct appeal, we will give him the benefit of the prison mailbox rule. And Kellogg basically said, you've only got 30 days to file that notice of appeal. So because of that 30 days, we will give you the benefit of the prison mailbox rule. When the Nevada Supreme Court decided Bishop's case, it didn't even mention Gonzales. Gonzales came out 10 years after Kellogg. And what the Nevada Supreme Court said in Gonzales, when the appellant argued that he should be entitled to the prison mailbox rule, they said, basically, you have a year, so we declined to extend the prison mailbox rule to post-conviction petitions for writs of habeas corpus.
Well, I understand what they did, but that's, of course, after the fact, from when people, based on Dictato, Kellogg, and others, assumed that if you deposited, as he did on the second, that either it would be deemed to be filed or it would be received by the deadline of the 7th. So there's not, I mean, you're telling me now what the Nevada Supreme Court went back and did under Gonzales, but is there anything in the case law or otherwise that would point to that decision as of May 2002, which was before the Gonzales decision?
All right. Well, Judge, first I disagree that the state of the law was that you got the benefit of the prison mailbox rule in filing a state post-conviction petition. The state statute says you have 1 year from the entry of judgment of conviction. They agreed to extend that in notice of direct appeal, but there was never any law that said we do extend it. Now, the representations that have been made that everybody was shocked by this is not true. It's never been addressed. I think the burden would be on
the appellate. You're basically saying it was simply undecided at the time he filed.
I wouldn't even say it was undecided. I would say that it had never been raised. So when it was finally raised 10 years after Kellogg, the Nevada Supreme Court declined to extend it. That doesn't mean that they were applying it during that 10-year period. Under the statute, under the Dickerson case, it would appear that they had not applied the prison mailbox rule to state post-conviction petitions. And I see that my time is up.
It has expired. Thank you very kindly. And your time long expired, but we asked you a lot of questions, and this is complicated, so we'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the Rule 59e motion, first of all, Harris, I'm not aware of any case before Harris that suggested that dictato was the subject of an equitable tolling argument. And I think it is a new rule in that sense. There's no other case that I know about.
The elephant in the room here is whether you made an argument in the district court at any time before the Rule 59e motion that equitable tolling should apply.
I did not, Your Honor. No, I did not do. I did not. Court's right, and that's absolutely correct. What I did do is, as soon as Harris came down about 2 weeks, 3 weeks before the ruling in this case, and within the time allotted by Rule 59e, I filed my 59e motion based on Harris as a new rule. Also, 59e motions are granted to correct manifest injustice and to make sure that there isn't such a thing. And as I've noted before, there would be a manifest injustice. Mr. Bishop did not get relief in this case, in my judgment. Also, this Court in the Jorss case, J-O-E-R-S-S, noted, I think, has noted that statutory tolling and equitable tolling are part of the same family. They may be different family members, but they're part of the same family. And it's not astonishingly different to move from statutory tolling to a related equitable tolling argument. But I did not make that argument earlier.
The evidence is quite different for statutory tolling and equitable tolling, isn't it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The evidence that one has to put forward to sustain equitable tolling is a fairly discrete pile of evidence.
I agree with that, Your Honor, although there often, as in this case, is tremendous overlap, particularly in the procedural history, which is critical to both, actually.
Counsel, if you would conclude, we'll give you just a moment to conclude if you have a final thought you want to leave us with.
I would just say on Gonzalez, the equal protection argument I made is critically important, I think. Mr. Bishop should be treated like the other folks. That's the law of this circuit. On Gonzalez, I noted in our briefs that we filed in the district court that the Attorney General's office at the Gonzalez argument, I believe, took the position that they were surprised that the mailbox rule was not applicable. I think most every lawyer in Nevada was surprised. And the most obvious reason that might support that is that the case was handled on the merits below. No one below, no judge, no lawyer, no one raised
even if it's a new rule, doesn't your client have to show diligence in filing? Here it was 2 months too late. Doesn't a requirement for equitable tolling, isn't a requirement that diligence be demonstrated?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and this man was diligent, as we noted, with no exhausted claims because there was no direct appeal. He couldn't effectively file any earlier. It would have been.
But he did file. He was just 2 months too late. Isn't that
when you're referring to
demonstration of lack of diligence?
You talking about his federal filing? I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Yes.
It really wasn't because if our argument's correct, it wasn't because he filed a day before the remitter, and the state proceeding wasn't final yet. So he filed well timely there. He waited until he completed his state filing to be sure he was exhausted, because he would have been kicked out of court.
Counsel, we understand your arguments, and you've exceeded your time.
Thank you very much.
The case just argued is submitted.